traveled, he read, he cooked, he made things. What, he whittled? No, no, I forgot, we're in Brooklyn. He knitted? Did he knit you that sweater? Hardly, Stephanie said. This sweater is Italian cashmere. She pointed to a custom bookcase lining the opposite wall, one Leo had admired earlier for its graceful economy. He built that.
Okay, I give, he said. It's a nice bookcase.
It's a fantastic bookcase.
So why isn't he here if he's so great?
Probably because his wife hasn't kicked him out of his apartment yet.
Right, Leo said. He deserved that one. He couldn't stop looking at the bookcase, which was, he had to admit, pretty fantastic.
And he wanted other things. Stephanie was quiet for a minute, thinking about what good company Will was and how she hadn't been able, ultimately, to make him happy. She still ran into him sometimes with his new wife. She didn't think they had kids yet. She looked up and thought, Leo. And then, careful. The storm outside was intensifying. The streets were quiet, devoid of pedestrians and traffic. The whole city seemed to be huddling against the weather. The fire cracked and hissed and warmed the room. Leo started to relax for the first time in weeks, for the first time since the accident, really. He missed Stephanie, the ease between them, her solid and comforting presence. Sitting across from him, in the light of the fire, she blazed with health and well-being and good humor.
"I can't believe you sold your business," he said.
"I can't believe what a hypocrite you are."
"I'm not a hypocrite. I speak from experience. I never should have sold out."
"You're just saying that now. I remember those days. You were thrilled by that fat check. Also, I'm not selling out. I was acquired. My life is just going to get a lot easier. I can't wait."
"I'm telling you," Leo said, "that was the start of the end for me."
Stephanie shrugged and took a clementine from a bowl on the table, started peeling it. "You could have stayed. Nathan wanted you to stay." Nathan Chowdhury had been Leo's business partner at Speakeasy Media. He'd worked behind the scenes, running the money side of things, and had stayed after the acquisition. Now he was CFO for the entire conglomerate. As far as Stephanie was concerned, the beginning of the end for Leo wasn't selling Speakeasy. It was acquiring Victoria, and all that came after. Namely, nothing. She still remembered the day he'd told her he was planning to sell. The day she'd visited him at work during a period when they were trying and nearly managing to be just friends. Victoria had walked into his office. "Hey," she'd said to Leo, lifting her eyebrows a bit, her smile even and smug. Stephanie heard it all in that one word, "hey." The intimate monotone of Victoria's low register, a kind of "hey" that said they'd woken up in the same bed that morning, probably could still smell each other on their hands. The "hey" wasn't inquisitive or demure or apologetic. It was territorial. Stephanie had heard that "hey" before, coming from her very own foolishly cocksure mouth. After Leo sold Speakeasy and married Victoria, he'd practically fallen off the face of the earth. The last thing in the world she needed from him was life or business advice.
"You should have called me," Leo said.
"Why would I have called you, Leo? When was the last time we spoke?" Stephanie wouldn't give him the satisfaction of telling him that she had called. She'd left a message on his cell, and someone identifying herself as Leo's personal assistant had called back. "Assisting what, exactly?" Stephanie had asked the girl, who sounded 16. "Does Leo have a job?" "Leo has a number of projects in the works," the girl had said. She sounded ridiculously tentative and nervous. Stephanie suspected she was using the assistant ruse to discover the identities of all the women on Leo's incoming call list. Well, good luck to her, she thought.
"Can I tell Leo what this is in reference to?" the girl had asked.
Stephanie had hung up and never called back.
"I've called you," Leo said. Before today? 2 years ago.
That's not true.
2 years.
Christ, Leo said.
Sorry.
He laughed a little. If it makes you feel any better, I stopped being interesting about 2 years ago.
I didn't feel particularly bad about it to begin with, but thanks.
He frowned and looked at her, still unbelieving and a little pained.
2 years?
Really?
Really,
she said.
So, come over here and tell me what else you've been up to, he said, patting the place next to him on the sofa.
Hours later, after they'd eaten the lamb and replenished the firewood and she filled him in on the recent publishing news and gossip, after he'd finished clearing the table and loading the dishwasher, poorly, and rinsing some pots, even worse, he opened another bottle of wine and she dished out bowls of ice cream and they moved back into the living room.
"Are you supposed to be drinking that?" she asked him, pointing to the glass of Cabernet.
"Technically, I guess not," he said. "But booze is not my issue, you know that."
"I don't know anything, Leo. You could be shooting heroin for all I know. In fact, I think I did hear something about heroin at some point."
"Completely false," he said. "Was there excess?"
"Yes."
"Do I realize I should probably steer clear of speed?"
"Yes."
"This," he raised the glass, "is not my problem."
"So are you going to tell me what happened? Do you want to talk about it?"
"Not really," Leo said. He wasn't sure what Stephanie had heard that she might not be telling him. George assured him everything was sealed tighter than a drum. He'd paid a fortune to keep Victoria quiet, but he didn't trust anyone. Stephanie let the silence gather some momentum. Out the front window, the snow accumulated, a pile 6 inches deep balanced precariously on the rail of a neighboring stoop. A lone car crept down the snowy street, fishtailing a little as it went. She could hear the kids in the house behind her out in their yard, screeching and laughing. Their dad was yelling, "Don't eat the snow, it's dirty!"
"We don't have to talk about it, Leo, but I'm a good secret keeper."
He felt the images from that night starting to surface. The sound of the car's brakes, the bite of salt air, the incongruous voice of Marvin Gaye coming from the SUV that hit them, urging him to get it on. He wondered if he should talk about it. He hadn't even tried at fake rehab. He wondered what Stephanie would say if he just unloaded the whole story right then and there. At one time, they'd told each other everything, or, he mentally corrected himself, she told him everything, and he told her what he thought she needed to hear. That hadn't gone very well.
"Leo?"
Leo didn't even know how to start talking about it. He stared at the carved face on the marble mantle and realized why it was familiar. The swoop of hair, the slender patrician nose, the appraising gaze.
"She looks like B," he said.
"Who does?"
"Lillian, your stone companion. She looks like B."
"B," Stephanie groaned and covered her eyes.
"She's not bad-looking, B."
"No, it's not that. She's called me a few times and I've been avoiding her. Something about new work."
"God, not the novel."
"No, no, no. I told her a long time ago that I wouldn't ever read that novel again. I told her, in fact, that she needed to find a new agent. Her message said something about a new project, but I just can't."
Stephanie stood and started picking up their empty bowls of ice cream. The tranquil mood broken.
"This is one of many reasons I'm happy to be part of a bigger operation," she said. "I can't stand feeling responsible for the formerly talented. It's too upsetting. I can pass her off to someone else who won't have any qualms about shutting her down."
Thinking about B being shut down by some unnamed assistant made Leo feel unexpectedly wistful. He wasn't surprised when her first stories ended up being some anomaly of youth and fearlessness, thanks to him, but she had to be at the end of her rope by now. And she'd been Stephanie's first notable client.
The person who'd made editors and other new writers take a very young Stephanie very seriously. He didn't like to think of Bea stuck working with Paul Underwood at some obscure literary journal, living in that apartment uptown by herself. It was hard to think about all his siblings for different reasons, so he didn't. Right now, it felt like there was nowhere for his thoughts to alight that wasn't rife with landmines of regret or anger or guilt. "You're right," Stephanie said, standing and staring at the mantel. "She does look like Bea."
"Shit."
"Don't go," Leo said.
"I'm just going to the kitchen."
"Stay here," he said. He didn't like the sound of his voice, how it wavered a little. He really didn't like the sudden, rapid acceleration of his heartbeat, which prior to this moment he'd associated with a certain class of stimulants, not a living room in Brooklyn in front of the fire with Stephanie.
"I'll be right back," Stephanie said.
Leo seemed to go slightly pale, and for a moment he looked lost, almost frightened, which briefly alarmed her.
"Leo?"
"I'm fine." He shook his head a little and stood. "Is that your old turntable?"
"Yes," she said. "Put something on. I'm just going to rinse these."
In the kitchen, Stephanie could hear Leo flipping through her record albums. He yelled to her from the living room, "Your taste in music still totally sucks." "Like everyone else in America, my music is on my computer. That's the old stuff. I just brought the turntable up from the basement a few months ago." Leo was reciting from the album covers. "Cyndi Lauper, Pat Benatar, Huey Lewis, Paula Abdul. This is like a bad MTV segment of Where Are They Now?" "More like, guess who joined the Columbia House Record Club when she was 18? Leo flinched a little hearing Columbia Records. He shook it off. "Ah, here we go," he said. Stephanie heard the turntable start to spin and the familiar scratch, scratch of the needle hitting the album grooves. Then the weirdly dissonant first notes of a piano and the slurry, graveled voice of Tom Waits filled the house.
"The piano has been drinking. My necktie is asleep."
Stephanie hadn't heard that song in years. Probably not since she and Leo were together. The album was probably Leo's. He would wake her up on his hungover mornings, many mornings, most mornings, singing that song. He would pull her sleeping self into his arms, his semi-erection pressing into her back. She would half-heartedly try to burrow farther down into the bed, clinging to sleep and the reassuring feel of Leo's limbs holding her close. "You stink," she would groan, feigning more irritation than she felt, not even really minding his funky breath. "You smell like my Uncle Howie after a night at the bar." He would sing into her ear, his voice pockmarked from whiskey.
"The piano has been drinking. Not me. Not me. Not me."
At the sink, she started to rewash the roasting pan that Leo had left with a film of grease on the counter, and tried to reconcile the Leo in her living room with the Leo she'd last seen almost 2 years ago. Out one night with Victoria, they'd both seemed hammered. This Leo was slimmer, and in spite of what she'd heard and occasionally witnessed about his recent years of late nights and marital troubles and general rabble-rousing, he somehow looked younger. He was quieter, more subdued, still funny, still quick, still beautiful. She shook her head. She was not, absolutely was not, going to get swept into Leo's orbit again. In fact, she'd better set down some hard and fast rules about how long he could stay, and she needed to run upstairs and make up the pull-out sofa in her office. Then, Leo was behind her, a hand on her shoulder. "Wanna dance?" he said. She laughed at him. "No," she said, "I most definitely do not want to dance with you. Also, you are terrible at washing dishes. Look at this." "I'm serious," he said. He lifted her hands out of the soapy water in the sink.
"Leo?"
She held herself rigid. I was clear. Her posture was combative, but he could hear something new in her voice, a fleeting hesitancy. He inched closer. You said no fucking. I respect the no fucking rule. Leo was entirely focused on her. His desire was physical. Yes, it had been 12 weeks, not counting a couple of breezy flings with the rehab physician's assistant in the weight room. But he also remembered how much he'd loved this part. Getting past her prickly exterior, cracking her wide open like unhinging an oyster. He hadn't thought about it in a long time. How satisfying it was to watch her steely carriage collapse a little, hear her breath catch. How good it felt to win. Fuck the firefighter. She sighed and looked past him, out the rear windows, into the Brooklyn night and the snowflakes ecstatically spinning in the beam of the floodlight on her back deck. Her hands were wet and cold, and the warmth of Leo's fingers around her wrists was disorienting. Leo couldn't read her expression. Resigned? Hopeful? Defeated? He didn't see desire yet, but he remembered how to summon it. Steph, he said. She smiled a little, but the smile was sad. I swear, Leo, she said quietly, nearly pleading. I'm happy. He was close enough now to lower his face to her neck and breathe in her skin, which smelled as it always had, faintly of chlorine, making him feel as if he could swim into her, assured and buoyant. They stood like that for a minute. He could feel his racing pulse gradually slow and align with the reliable rhythm of her constant heart. He pulled back a little to look at her. He ran his thumb along her lower lip, the same way he had with the marble carving earlier, only this time the lip yielded. And then, from the backyard, an enormous crash splitting the outdoor quiet like a clap of thunder. Then flickering lights. Then darkness. Chapter 7. When Leo arrived at the Oyster Bar, he worked some magic with the surly maitre d'. Within minutes, the plums were seated and had unconsciously arranged themselves around the red-checkered tablecloth according to birth order. Leo, Jack, B, Melody. They shed coats and hats and made a little too much of ordering just water and coffee. Leo apologized for running late and explained how he was staying with a friend in Brooklyn. Stephanie, B realized, and he'd taken the wrong train and had to retrace his steps. Obligatory chatter about how Brooklyn had become so crowded and expensive and why was the subway so unreliable on the weekends anyway, and, well, the weather certainly didn't help. Snow in October. Then they all fell uncomfortably silent, except Leo, who seemed utterly calm while appraising his brother and sisters, who all looked back at him, ill at ease. The three of them wondered how he did it, how he always managed to be unruffled while putting everyone else on edge. How even in this moment, at this lunch, where Leo should be abashed, laid bare, and the balance of power could have, should have shifted against him, he still commanded their focus and exuded strength. Even now they were deferentially waiting, hoping he would speak first. But he just sat, watching them, curiously attentive. "It's good to see you," Bee finally said. "You look well. Healthy." Her light affection made Jack's shoulders relax, Melody's face unclench. Leo smiled. "I'm happy to see you all. I am." Melody felt herself blush. Embarrassed, she put her hands to her cheeks. "I guess we should get right to it," Leo said. In the taxi down from Central Park, he'd decided to address the unpleasantness head-on. He realized, somewhat surprisingly, that he'd given precious little thought to this moment during his long weeks at Bridges. He'd been so focused on Victoria and the dissolution of their marriage that he'd failed to consider the repercussions of Francie's actions. To be fair, he hadn't entirely understood Francie's actions until a couple of weeks ago. When George first told him that his mother was funding the Rodriguez payout, Leo'd had a brief moment of hope that she was using her own, or Harold's, considerable resources. Alas, I know you want to talk about the nest, he continued, satisfied to see their surprise at his direct approach. So first, I want to say, thank you. I know you didn't have to agree with Francie's plan, and I'm grateful. Bee looked at Melody and Jack, who both shifted a little in their seats. They all looked confused and troubled. What? Leo said, processing what was happening a minute too late.
We hardly had any choice in the matter, Jack said.
We didn't know until it was done, Melody said.
Really? Leo turned to Bee. She nodded.
Ah. Leo leaned back and looked around the table. Of course. He mentally berated himself for that bit of miscalculation while, briefly, experiencing a wave of elation because Francie had acted so decisively and singularly on his behalf. But Leo quickly realized he was wrong about that, too. Francie hadn't come to his rescue. No doubt she'd rescued herself and Harold. Leo could hear Harold now, his adenoidal voice going on and on about what was all over the East End. Bee warily watched Leo absorb this new bit of information.
I tried calling you, Leo, she said, many times.
Right, he said. Okay. This complicated things. When Leo and Victoria were first engaged, shortly after he sold Speakeasy and went on sabbatical, as he thought of it, and after she refused to consider a prenup, he'd opened an offshore account during one of their diving trips to Grand Cayman. He'd acted on a whim while she was off shopping. The account was perfectly legal, and although he'd planned on telling Victoria about it, he found himself not telling her. He thought of it as a little insurance, a private pension of sorts, maybe a way to keep some of his money protected in case of a stormy day. As his marriage began to deteriorate, he started bolstering the balance. One upside to the prodigious way he and Victoria spent money was that she stopped noticing where the money went. A few thousand here, a few thousand there. Over the years, it added up. He thought about the money all the time and the day he would just pick up and leave. What had kept him from doing it years ago was the hope that Victoria would tire of him first, fall in love with someone else, and leave him so he could avoid a financially decimating divorce. When it became clear she never would, why couldn't he have married someone just as beautiful but not so strategic? He surrendered fully to the more libertine aspects of his life. He wasn't sorry to see the diminishing balances on their joint accounts. So even though the accident had been a humiliating and unfortunate event, it had also, in a strange way, loosened him from the life he was already desperate to escape. For months, he'd expected Victoria's lawyers to find and triumphantly expose the funds, but nobody had. He had nearly $2 million hidden away, almost exactly what he owed the nest. He'd never touched a penny of the low-interest savings account. It was safe and sound, liquid. If he replenished the fund to pay his siblings, his $2 million would be divided by four. The math hardly worked in his favor. I wish I had the money sitting somewhere and could write you all a check, Leo said. He placed his palms flat on the table and leaned forward, looking each one of them straight in the eye. He hadn't run a company for all those years without learning the art of a quick recalculation, without learning how to work a table. He still mostly needed to bide time. But I don't. I'm going to need some time, Leo continued.
How much time? Melody said, a little too quickly.
I wish I had the answer to that, Leo said, as if having that answer was his most fervent desire on earth. But I promise you this. I am going to start working immediately and hard to rebuild. I already have some ideas. I've already started making some calls.
What's the plan? Jack said.
He wanted specifics. Is there a way for you to borrow the money you owe us, pay us off, and owe somebody else?
Very possibly, Leo said, knowing that his chances of getting anyone to lend him money at the moment were nil. A lot of things are possible.
Like what else? Jack said.
Leo shook his head. I don't want to throw out a lot of what-ifs and maybes.
Do you think you might have the money, or at least some of it, when we were expecting to get it?
Melody asked. In March? Leo said.
February. My birthday's in February,
Melody said, too panicky over how the conversation was going to be indignant.
I'm March, said B.
Right. Leo beat out a little rhythm on the table with his thumb and pinky. He looked like he was doing a complex equation in his head. They all waited. How about this? He finally said. Give me 3 months.
To pay us? Jack said.
No, but to have a plan. A solid plan. I don't think I'm going to need 3 months, but you know how tough financing is these days. He directed his last comment at Jack. You're a business owner. Jack nodded in solemn agreement. B suppressed the urge to roll her eyes. Leo, he really was full of shit. And figure in the holidays when it's tough to pin people down. I think I need 3 months to come up with options, he said. Ideally, more than one option that will have you seeing full payment as soon as possible. I'm not promising February, but I am promising that I'll work as hard as I've ever worked on anything to try and make good. He looked around the table again. I'm asking you to trust me. Part 2. The Kiss. Chapter 8. Paul Underwood ran his literary magazine, Paper Fibers, from a small warren of offices up a worn flight of stairs in a slightly sagging building that stood in the shadow of the Manhattan Bridge. He'd bought the 4-story brick front before the Dumbo section of Brooklyn became Dumbo, when the masses of migrating Manhattanites had been priced out of Brooklyn Heights and Cobble Hill, but still had their hearts set on the aesthetically pristine, historically important, and relatively affordable brownstones of Park Slope or Fort Greene. He'd stumbled into the small wedge of a neighborhood one bright summer Saturday after walking across the Brooklyn Bridge. Leisurely heading north, he'd found himself wandering through the industrial blocks and admiring the streets of blue-gray Belgian bricks laid out in appealing patterns, threaded through with defunct trolley tracks. He'd noted with approval the absence of expensive clothing boutiques, high-priced coffee shops, restaurants with exposed brick and wood-burning ovens. Every fourth building seemed to be an auto body shop or some kind of appliance repair. He liked the vibe of the place. It reminded him of Soho back when Soho had energy and grit, a little theatrical menace. Down by the waterfront, a sign indicated that the scrubby park populated with crack dealers and their customers was slated for expansion and renovation. And he noticed that the same developer had signs all over the neighborhood heralding the arrival of warehouse-to-condo conversions. Standing on a corner of Plymouth Street that afternoon, in the waning days of the 20th century, listening to the clank and rattle of truck beds as they rumbled over the approach to the Manhattan Bridge to his north, watching the sun illuminate the massive arches of the Brooklyn Bridge to the south, Paul Underwood saw his future. A for sale placard on a seemingly abandoned corner building. At the top of the building's reddish-brown facade, he could make out the faded white letters of a sign from the long-defunct business the dwelling once housed. Plymouth Paper Fibers, Inc. He took the sign as an omen. He bought the building the following week and started his literary journal, Paper Fibers, the following year. Paul lived on the top floor of the building, 2 bedrooms, nicely renovated, meticulously furnished, spectacular views, directly above the Paper Fibers offices, which were crammed into the front half of the 3rd floor. The back half of the 3rd floor and the entire 2nd floor housed 2 modest but increasingly lucrative rental apartments. At street level, there was a lingerie store. La Rosa didn't sell fancy lingerie, nothing lacy or push-up or see-through, but what Paul thought of as old lady lingerie, matron underwear. Even the plastic torso mannequins in the windows looked uncomfortable, bound tightly with brassieres and girdles that resembled straitjackets with their rows of steel hooks, dangling elastic belts, and reinforced shoulder straps. Paul had no idea how they stayed in business, had never seen more than one customer in there at a time. He had his suspicions, but the rent check was on time every month, so as far as he was concerned, La Rosa could launder hosiery or money, or sell whatever they liked to the odd selection of male customers who usually left empty-handed. Paul went to great pains to keep his home and work life separate. He never brought work upstairs. He never appeared in the Paper Fiber's offices in what he thought of as civilian clothes, always dressing for the commute one quick flight down. Every morning he put on one of his exquisitely tailored suits and chose a bow tie from his vast collection. He believed the butterfly shape beneath his chin provided a necessary counterweight to his overly long face and inelegant hair, which was baby fine, mousy brown, and tended to stick out around his ears or at the crown. "You can get away with colorful ties," his ex-wife had told him, diplomatically referring to his rather unremarkable features, gray eyes that were more watery than striking, thin lips, a soft, almost putty-like nose. Paul never minded his ordinary looks. They lent a valuable invisibility in certain situations. He overheard things he wasn't supposed to hear. People confided in him, errantly judging him harmless. His looks didn't always work in his favor. There was the recent lunch, for example, which he'd scheduled with a young poet after their email exchanges had turned flirtatious. That she'd been disappointed in his appearance versus the muscular wit of his correspondence had been abundantly clear by the look on her face. Well, he'd been surprised, too. Surprised to discover that she didn't remotely resemble her author photo with its glossy hair, hooded eyes, and come-hither glistening lips. Paul valued routine and habit. He ate the same breakfast every day, a bowl of oatmeal and an apple, and then went for a morning walk along Fulton Ferry Landing. On weekdays, he never deviated from his route, becoming an expert chronicler of the waterfront in all its seasonal mutations. Today the wind was fierce, battering the hardy souls brave enough to be outside. He leaned into it, pitching himself forward and wrapping his scarf more tightly around his neck. He loved the river, even during the grim New York winter, loved its steely gray shimmer and menacing white caps. He never tired of the view of the harbor. He always felt lucky to be exactly where he was, the place he'd chosen to belong. As he headed toward the far edge of Fulton Ferry Landing, Paul saw Leo Plum's familiar figure sitting on one of the benches closest to the water. Leo and Paul had taken to walking together every so often. Leo looked up and waved. Paul picked up his pace. He'd actually begun to look forward to the days when Leo would join him at the bench. Stranger things had happened, he supposed. Paul had been livid when Speakeasy magazine folded, and Leo hadn't invited him to help start the website that would eventually grow into Speakeasy Media. Leo hadn't taken everyone from the print magazine, but he'd taken those generally considered the sharpest, the most desirable, and Paul had always believed himself to fit squarely in that category. Maybe he wasn't the most talented writer, the most fearless reporter, but he was reliable and capable and ambitious, and shouldn't all those things count for something? He met deadlines, his copy was pristine, and he pitched in where needed even when it wasn't his responsibility. He did everything you were supposed to do to earn the things you wanted. He was nice. That no one else was surprised Paul wasn't going with Leo was also a blow. He kept waiting for the shocked looks, the crooked finger beckoning him behind a closed door. Leo isn't taking you? When it didn't happen, he realized nobody else considered him prime pickings either. He'd mustered the nerve to ask Leo about it once. Underwood, this is not going to be your scene, Leo'd said, putting a heavy palm on Paul's shoulder and holding his gaze in that way Leo had, the way that made you simultaneously flattered to command his full attention, and slightly brain-addled, unable to capture a train of thought. You would hate it. You're an in-depth feature guy. I wouldn't do it to you, and I'm paying peanuts. Paul comforted himself with Leo's explanation for a while. He probably would hate gossip, It was true that Paul specialized in the longer cultural pieces, and he wasn't willing to work for nothing. But then Paul discovered that Leo had hired Gordon Fitzgerald as content editor at the new speakeasy. Gordon wasn't any more interested in short form or gossip than Paul, and he was sure Gordon wasn't working for peanuts. Paul had supervised Gordon, he'd recruited him, and he knew that Gordon was nothing but trouble, a drunk and a world-class dick. For months after Leo left, Paul freely offered his opinion of the new venture. Dead in the water in 6 months. He had, of course, been preposterously wrong. Paul didn't know what had happened to land Leo in rehab because the public details were sketchy and B was close-mouthed. He'd heard rumors about a car accident out in the Hamptons. Leo's wife, Victoria, had been seen around town with a number of high-profile dates. Leo seemed to be shacking up, again, with Stephanie Palmer in Brooklyn. His Porsche was gone. When Leo appeared in his offices one morning in November, ostensibly looking for B, Paul didn't think anything of it. But Leo was there for hours, nosing around Paul's office, asking questions about issue scheduling, advertising deadlines, print sales, subscriptions, finances. He wanted to know about the magazine's online presence, slim, writer relationships, robust, and how Paul would expand if he could. If you had all the funding you wanted. And then Paul thought he understood. "Nathan sent you here," Paul said. "You two are working together again." It made sense. They used to be partners, and Paul thought his recent meeting with Nathan had been promising. Leo held Paul's gaze in a way that seemed significant and said, "Officially? No. Officially? This is just a friendly visit." "I see," Paul said. He didn't see, but hoped to God that Leo was there on unofficial, official Nathan business. At one of the countless holiday parties he'd attended in December, he couldn't even remember which one. They all blurred. All the cheap Prosecco and waxy cubes of cheese and gluten-free cupcakes. One of his old speakeasy colleagues mentioned that he'd heard Nathan was thinking about starting a literary magazine, or investing in one. "As a write-off?" Paul asked, unable to imagine any other reason. "I think it's more of an ego thing," his friend had said. "Something respectable and highbrow to balance the other stuff." The other stuff, Paul knew, referred not just to the gossipy, lowbrow nature of speakeasy media's online presence, but to the softcore porn site that generated most of the company's revenue. "Any idea who he's considering?" "None. You should call him. The money he's willing to throw at someone is chump change for him, but probably massive by your standards." Paul had been on the phone scheduling a meeting the next day. Keeping paper fibers afloat sometimes felt like trying to cross the Atlantic Ocean in a leaky skiff. He was constantly plugging one hole just to have another appear and then another, and he felt like the whole venture was going to sink more times than he cared to think about. The rental income from his building, in addition to allowing him to work and live rent-free, provided some income, enough to pay himself, B, and his one other full-time employee, a managing editor who spent most of her time filling out grant applications and chatting up prospective donors and trying to keep existing contributors from turning fickle, a modest income. Paper fibers had a solid subscription base, as far as those things went, and even managed a decent amount of advertising revenue, but not enough to cover all his costs and pay writers and keep his related projects thriving. The majority of outside funding came from Paul's two elderly aunts, his deceased father's sisters who'd never married and treated Paul like a son. They were a certain type of elderly New Yorker, sharing the same rent-controlled apartment within walking distance of Lincoln Center for decades and decades. Voracious readers, eager travelers, regulars at all kinds of readings and the Broadway Wednesday matinee. They had annual subscriptions to the Ballet, Carnegie Hall, and the 92nd Street Y, and box seats at Shea Stadium. Every January since he'd started his publication, They sent an extremely generous check. The sisters' fund, as he thought of it, and how he listed it on the contributors page, which thrilled them, was how he could pay writers and manage, once or twice a year, to publish a book under his very modest imprint. Usually a poetry collection, the occasional novella, or a book of essays. 2 years ago, the January check had been a little less. The following year, less still. And last month, nearly half what it used to be. Paul would never question them, but he worried that maybe something was wrong and they weren't telling him. He invited them out, as he did every January, to thank them for their contribution. Drinks at the Algonquin and dinner at Keene's Steakhouse. Before Paul got a chance to ask if everything was all right, they brought up the diminishing checks, speaking in their typical fashion almost as one person. He was used to their eccentricity by now, but on the few occasions they stopped by his office, just to have a look around, he realized how they appeared to others. "Like those Grey Gardens ladies," one of the interns had said once admiringly, "minus the dementia and cats." "We're so sorry," they told him over lunch. "It seems we're going through our retirement fund a little more quickly than is ideal. Our accountant has put his foot down, dear. He's trying to get us to cut all expenses by half. Especially ones he deems unnecessary, anything charitable. You can imagine our distress. Of course, we initially refused, but then he summoned us to his office, like a principal bringing truants called to account. It was mortifying. Mortifying. He had charts. Not charts, graphs. They were very colorful. Very." Mutual and grave nodding commenced. Paul waited. "You see, the amount of red on the future projected income, red isn't good. I realize that nobody wants red on the charts," Paul said. "Graphs." They looked so troubled, avoiding eye contact, drinking their wine too fast, that he quickly reassured them he understood. "You've done so much already," Paul said. "You've done more than enough. Our check will be a little less every year, but you can count on us for something." "I'm afraid we've lived too long. Who would have thought? Especially after all those years of smoking, all the red meat. We'll be lucky if there's anything left for our funeral when that day comes." Paul decided to ignore the odd sentence construction. The assumption that two people would have one funeral on the same day. Although it was impossible to imagine one sister without the other. Although he thought he'd have more time, Paul knew this day would come eventually. His aunts wouldn't live forever. Countless times he'd tried to get a better handle on the business side of things, his tenuous finances, but he hated the business side of things. He was trying to figure out how to redouble his funding efforts when he serendipitously heard the chatter about Nathan and arranged a meeting. Nathan hadn't committed to anything, but he'd been engaged, curious. He'd asked lots of questions, and Paul offered intelligent, thought-out answers. Why wouldn't he? He thought all the time about what he would do if he had more money. The website was pathetic. Nothing more than a place to subscribe and submit, and many of his writers were frustrated their content wasn't available online. He wanted to publish more books, many more books. He wanted to expand the modest but respected reading series he ran, start a summer conference, and maybe open a writing center for at-risk youth. But it would all take more money than he'd ever had. "Let's both think on it a little more," Nathan had said. "I'll be in touch in a few weeks." And then there was Leo, standing in his office and looking around and asking questions. "Unofficially," Paul said to Leo, "is there anything specific you'd like to know about how things work here?" Since then, he and Leo had met a handful of times, usually starting at the bench in the morning. They'd stroll, get coffee, and talk mostly about work and the challenges of running a literary magazine. But about other things, too, Real estate, the rapidly expanding Brooklyn waterfront, city politics. Paul still wasn't sure what Leo was after. He assumed more than one person would be in the running for Nathan's dollars, so he was trying his hardest to impress Leo, walking him through every stage of putting the summer issue together, occasionally pretending to solicit Leo's advice and then feeling pleasantly surprised at his excellent input. Paul had forgotten. It had been easy to forget, given Leo's gradual morph from new media celebrity into his glaring life of unrepentant indulgence, how cunning Leo could be about the printed word. Leo's instincts were infuriatingly effortless and accurate, and Paul couldn't help enjoying him and their lively exchanges. It was, in fact, Leo's presence that made Paul Underwood rekindle the tiny ember he'd consigned to a much smaller place, that was the thought of kissing Beatrice Plum. Over the years, Paul had had a few carefully selected lovers. They came and went, some more than once. He'd been married briefly, but didn't seem to have the knack for it. But he had loved Beatrice Plum for nearly always. His love for her was quiet and constant, familiar and soothing. It was almost its own thing entirely, like a worn rock or a set of worry beads, something he'd pick up and weigh in his palm occasionally, more comforting than dispiriting. Paul suspected Bea would never love him, but he thought maybe, one day, she might let him kiss her. He was a very good kisser. He'd been told so often enough to have confidence in that skill and to know that a good kiss, perfectly timed, well executed, could establish inroads to far more interesting destinations. He'd thought about kissing Beatrice for so many years that he knew he should probably never try, that the reality would almost have to pale in comparison to his many, many years of imagining the kiss and how it would unfold. In the back of a taxi on a sultry rainy night, on a stalled subway train as the lights flickered off, under the elegantly tiled archways of Bethesda Terrace as the sun was low in the sky, and his favorite, in the sculpture garden at MoMA, both so overcome by the lush, rotund Henry Moores that they turned to each other simultaneously, needing the same exact press of flesh at the same exact moment. Paul had spent the last decade watching Bea's light dim, and it was troubling. Not only because he cared deeply about Bea as a writer and a person, but also because he suspected her slow fade played a part in his waning libidinous thoughts about her. He wasn't attracted to failure. He preferred his women dedicated and ambitious. Bea had stopped talking about her book years ago. He never saw her sneaking time to write or even scribble on index cards or in a notebook. Some days he wanted to fire her, make her leave the office and do something else, anything else. But he couldn't. He wouldn't. Bea seemed revived lately. There was something newly engaging and ardent about her. He'd overheard her make reference to a new writing project. He knew better than to ask. He'd wait for her to bring it up. He wondered if she'd shown Leo the new stuff yet. He hoped so, because he would trust Leo's opinion. If Leo thought whatever she was doing had potential, well, who knew? What could be more perfect for a newly expanded fiction imprint than the long-awaited debut novel by Beatrice Plum? Anything she wrote would attract attention, along with the entity that published the work. Maybe he would pull Leo aside and ask if he'd heard or seen anything. He could picture it perfectly. The publishing party at a local independent bookstore, Bea surrounded by an eager, appreciative crowd, her bright eyes and fluttering fingers, her long braids coiled and pinned up at the nape of her neck, just how he loved. She would turn to him, tender and eager with gratitude, flush with accomplishment, and he would touch her elbow, kiss her cheek as he'd done a thousand times before. But this time he would linger just a little longer, long enough for her to notice. A shadowy declaration. A first kiss in the bookstacks. Now that was romantic.
Chapter 9. The sole reason Bea Plum agreed to accompany Paul Underwood to the dinner party at Celia Baxter's on the Upper West Side, sure to be jammed with the exact type of people, writers, editors, agents, she couldn't avoid at work, but desperately tried to avoid at all other times, was because Celia was one of Stephanie's closest friends from college. Celia was not of the publishing world. She was of the art world. But those worlds often collided, especially over cocktails. Bea hoped to see Stephanie at the smallish gathering in Celia's intentionally stark and under-decorated apartment, which was only a few blocks, but worlds away, from Bea's place. It would be easy for her to duck out if the event was unbearable. Just past the new year, heading into the dreariest weeks of the calendar, almost 3 months since the Oyster Bar lunch, and Bea was still dithering about showing her new work to any of the three people, Leo, Paul, Stephanie, who could or should see it. After her phone call with Jack earlier in the week, she felt a new urgency. Jack said he was heading out to Brooklyn to see Leo. He was vague about why. "Do I need a reason to visit my brother?" he'd said. "I want to see how he's doing." "And?" Bea had asked. "And, okay, I want to see what's going on. Has he said anything to you?" "No," Bea had said, trying to think of something to tell Jack that might assuage him but also be the truth. "He looks good." "What a relief," Jack said, his tone sour. "I mean, he looks healthy, alert, and focused. He seems optimistic. He's been hanging out with Paul. I think they're working on something."
"You're joking."
"Why would that be a joke?"
"This is his big plan? Working for that putz, Paul Underwood?"
"I work for Paul Underwood," Bea said.
"I realize that, and I mean this as a compliment. There are lots of things you would be willing to do that Leo wouldn't."
"I know."
Bea did know. Leo's interest in Paul was bewildering. Paul seemed to believe Leo was working with Nathan Chowdhury again, but Bea found that unlikely. And Leo had never liked Paul. Ever. He'd called him Paul Underdog behind his back for years and had only shown a grudging kind of interest in paper fibers or what Bea did every day. He'd been visibly shocked to discover that Paper Fibers was a thriving publication. Not that she ever volunteered to talk about work. Nobody was more dismayed than she was to find herself still going to the same office every day. Over the years, she'd managed to assume mostly managerial duties. She eagerly took on any job that removed her from working with writers and let Paul be the editing face of the magazine, which he loved. He still sought her input and shrewd pen, but those exchanges happened between the two of them, in private.
"Apparently Leo's meeting with Nathan," Bea told Jack.
"Nathan? Nathan?
"Yes." She knew Jack would be happy to hear Nathan's name. Everyone would.
"Well, that's very interesting. Sounds like the perfect time for an in-person progress report."
She didn't tell Jack what else she thought about Leo. That for all the moments he seemed terrifically healthy and eager and nearly like his old self. His old, old self. The Leo she loved so much and missed even more. There were nearly an equal number of times he seemed remote and anxious. Bea knew Leo better than anyone. On the surface he was fine, stellar even. But she'd also seen him staring out the office windows, jiggling his leg, eyeing the harbor and the ocean beyond, like a death row prisoner from Alcatraz who was wondering exactly what distance the body could survive the open water in February. That was partly why she chickened out every time she thought to talk to him about what she was writing. If Jack was going to start putting pressure on Leo, and Bea realized it was a bit of a miracle he'd held off for this long, she needed to do something. Once his divorce was final, Leo would be free to roam. She didn't understand what was going on with him and Stephanie,
but those two made Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton look like slouches in the on-again-off-again department. But this she knew. She needed to figure out what to do. She needed to commit to what she was writing, or move on to something else while she was writing, before her confidence and inspiration fled. Again. She'd been hiding in a corner of Celia's enormous living room, pretending to examine the bookshelves, which were full of what she thought of as fake books. The books were real enough, but if Celia Baxter had read Thomas Pynchon or Samuel Beckett or even all, any, of the Philip Roths and Saul Bellows lined in a row, she'd eat her mittens. In a far upper corner of the bookcase, she noticed a lurid purple book spine, a celebrity weight loss book. Ha! That was more like it. She stood on tiptoe, slid the book out, and examined the well-thumbed, stained pages. She returned it to the shelf front and center, between Mythologies and Cloud Atlas. Satisfied, she waded into the crowd to find Paul. Maybe he wouldn't mind if she left. If Stephanie wasn't here by now, she wasn't coming. B heard Lena Novak before she saw her. That old, familiar hyena laugh. She froze, thinking she had to be wrong, only to see her old... Her old what? They hadn't been friends, but they hadn't exactly been enemies either, heading in her direction. B could not handle Lena Novak right now. Absolutely could not. She turned on her heel and fled into a nearby powder room, nearly slamming the door behind her. Seeing herself in the mirror, she was only mildly surprised by how terrified she looked. Lena Novak was another one of the glittery girls who, unlike Bee, had gone on to publish a well-regarded book every few years. Bee had recently stumbled across a feature in a glossy magazine on Lena and her handsome architect husband and adorable daughter and their ingeniously renovated Brooklyn townhouse and the horse barn turned weekend home in Litchfield, Connecticut. She'd been increasingly nauseated by every paragraph, and had finally tossed the magazine into the recycling bin at work. "Hey, I wanted to read that," one of the interns had said, fishing it out of the bright blue receptacle. "I love Lena Novak." In the powder room, Bee washed her hands and found an old lipstick in the corner of her purse. She carefully applied the color, checking to make sure none of it was on her teeth. She used her dampened fingers to calm the hair around her face that had frizzed under her winter hat. She moved as slowly as possible, trying to remember where her coat had been ferried off to and the most direct route to the front door. She eyed a glass shelf housing an impressive collection of tiny antique perfume bottles. "Really?" she thought. "Where do people get the time?" And then, "Who am I kidding? I have the time." Someone rapped gently on the door. "Hold on," she said. She squared her shoulders, happy that she'd worn her favorite zebra print wrap dress from her favorite secondhand clothing store. She took a deep breath and opened the door. Maybe Lena wouldn't even recognize her, she thought, as she walked into the front hall. But the moment she emerged from the tiny powder room, Lena pounced, squealing and pulling Bee into an alarmingly fierce hug. "I heard you were here, but I didn't believe it," she said, rocking Bee a little as if they'd just been reunited after a lengthy, involuntary separation. The glittery girls were just an invention of some journalist for an urban magazine. Bee had been horrified when the article came out, which made them sound like silly socialites. Perched on a Soho rooftop on a languid summer night, the most buzzed-about writers in Manhattan glitter like beads on a particularly smart necklace. The breathless writing was awful. The designation didn't even make sense. A meaningless phrase assigned to a group of female writers who happened to live in New York City at the same time. Happened to be around the same age, and, for the most part, disliked one another. At best, they were grudging acquaintances bound by a name they all wished they could shake. Except for Lena, who had adored the catchphrase and taken it literally. Literally, Bea had joked to the one woman in the group she actually liked, a poet from Hoboken who had also seemed to drop off the face of the earth in the ensuing years. Back then, Lena was always trying to gather the girls for drinks or dinners or suggesting they go to events together, as if they were a lounge act in Vegas.
"You look exactly the same,"
Lena held Bea at arm's length and gushed.
"Come sit and talk to me."
She clapped her hands and her bared cleavage bounced a little. Had she bought herself new breasts, too? Bea didn't remember Lena ever being voluptuous. They sat in a quiet corner of the dining room next to an enormous table covered with trays of meticulously made